Rubin v. Bell. Mr. Jaslowski.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bill Jaslowski and I represent the appellant, Phil Rubin, who is also the debtor in the underlying proceedings. The issue we present today raises a pure question of law. It's well defined and it comes to you on a clean record. That question is whether a cost award entered against a debtor by an arbitration panel, which panel was only considering pre-petition claims against the debtor, is itself a pre-petition claim, or instead was that cost award somehow transformed into a post-petition claim, thus becoming immune from discharge simply because the debtor participated in the arbitration that took place post-petition. Now, the bankruptcy court, which deals with these issues every day, held in the detailed opinion that the cost award, just like all the other claims in the arbitration, must be a pre-petition claim. They go hand in hand. Since only pre-petition claims were being arbitrated, any cost award related thereto must likewise be deemed a pre-petition claim. The bankruptcy court summed it up pretty elegantly, saying the cost award, quote, arose from Rubin's, that's the debtor, arose from Rubin's alleged pre-petition conduct and Bell's pre-petition lawsuit against him for that very conduct. It is therefore a pre-petition claim covered by the discharge. I am here today
why was arbitration used rather than litigation in the bankruptcy court on those claims?
Couple reasons, Judge. First of all, there was an adversary filed by Ms. Bell. Before, she originally filed suit in 2008 against Mr. Rubin and 40 others. Many claims brought. I think it was a 13-count complaint in state court. The defendants moved to compel arbitration originally. It stemmed from a contract, from an agreement, an engagement letter. Then next, Mr. Rubin files his bankruptcy in 2010, 2 years later. After that, she files her adversary. After that, the most relevant factor...
And her adversary essentially incorporated the same claims from the state court proceeding, right?
More than essentially incorporated. That literally mimicked word for word.
So Rubin was not required to arbitrate at that point, was he?
Correct. We could have continued with, call it, parallel inefficient proceedings.
Right. So it was his choice to arbitrate.
Arguably, yes, it was his choice, but what's lost in this, and this is what the district court eventually glommed onto, the factual predicate of who did what when did he move to join, when did she file her original case, it's a red herring. I'm loath to go down that road. It's a rabbit hole of sorts because, again, she sued him first. Next, she filed the arbitration. Next, she was already proceeding against these other non-debtor defendants. The arbitration was going forward, period. It was proceeding without him, and it would have continued to its completion with or without him. But the most interesting thing, if we're going to go down this road, she reopened his bankruptcy case to arbitrate her negligence but not her fraud claim. So the arbitration's going on. She files her adversary. After she files her adversary, which mimics these same non-dischargeability counts, she moves to reopen his bankruptcy case, says to the bankruptcy court, we'd like to arbitrate our negligence claims against Mr. Rubin, but not the fraud claims for now. We consented to that, had no problem with that. The reason she wanted to do that because of insurance proceeds. After that, her claims for non-dischargeability against Mr. Rubin, of course, they needed to be heard somewhere, had to be heard somewhere. And finally, to be clear, once Mr. Rubin moved to reopen his bankruptcy case, call it the second opening, she moved the first time, he's moving the second time, he did so saying, well, the arbitration's going forward, you're arbitrating your negligence claims against me, why not have it all in one proceeding? For all the reasons you judges already know, judicial economy, efficiency, consistency of verdicts. She consented to that. We entered an agreed order to arbitrate all the claims there. So again, I'm loath to go down this road because it's a legally irrelevant distinction. Regardless of where these claims were ultimately litigated, they are pre-petition claims. They go hand in hand. The only cases they're able to cite, which the bankruptcy court dismissed, are cases where the debtor, when the arbitration goes forward, has something to gain. The debtor can win something. Here, by definition, the only thing Mr. Rubin was doing was defending her claims for non-dischargeability. So in the other cases, for instance, in Haddon, the case of the 1986 Wisconsin bankruptcy.
But if every one of these proceedings that grow out of a post-petition, pre-petition claim, if all of those are treated as pre-petition claims, what is to prevent the person defending against the claim to just, you know, act with total irresponsibility because anything that happens in this post-petition proceeding is going to be discharged.
Well, there's
any additional debt he incurs fighting the trustee, it's going to be discharged if it's treated as a pre-petition claim.
Well, when you talk about judge total irresponsibility, the cases are clear that if in this other proceeding there's something akin to sanctions, which, think about it, that deals with new conduct. You're doing a new act, a new post-petition act. Here, everything stems.
Isn't that what those costs are, though, that they're the costs of the arbitrators who are hearing the claims?
They are mostly the cost of the arbitrators hearing the claim.
And the length of the hearing that they have to hold, in part, depends on what Mr. Rubin does.
Well, in part, this was against many co-defendants. As Judge Doyle pointed out in her, I think it was 20-page opinion, she addressed this argument and called it a red herring as well, stating that even if the case had proceeded with the adversary, and if for some reason Judge Doyle asserted cost against us, even as the, quote, prevailing party or whatever nomenclature you want, they would still be a pre-petition claim. I mean, the best way to
But why would the costs be discharged? I don't get that. If the costs are incurred because of conduct in the subsequent proceeding, I don't know why that should be discharged.
Because if you carry it to its logical conclusion, I'll give you the best.
No, I don't want a logical conclusion. I want a reason why costs or other, impositions, which are the nature of sanctions, should be discharged.
The short answer, Judge, is it stems from the definition of a claim in the bankruptcy code.
No, not a definition of a claim. I want something sensible, right?
What's sensible?
It's one thing, you get into trouble, you can't pay your debts, you declare bankruptcy, you get a discharge, you have your free start. That's okay. That's basic. But if in the course of the bankruptcy proceeding you impose costs on your opponent, and as a result he has a claim against you for those costs, why on earth should you be entitled to a discharge?
There's no problem with it being deemed a claim. The question is, does it stem from pre-petition conduct and pre-petition acts?
Look, you're not answering my question. I want an answer why it makes sense to allow a discharge of a debtor who in the bankruptcy proceeding is imposing unnecessary expense on his creditors.
Because he wasn't imposing unnecessary expenses on his creditors. The claims that she brought against him that he was defending, that needed to be defended somewhere, somehow, her claims for fraud, they were going to be defended somewhere, so there was no imposition, and they all stem, call it akin to the fruit of the
poison.
But
do you agree that if a sanction is imposed in these adversary proceedings, the sanction should not be discharged, even though the proceeding arose from a pre-petition.
In a word, yes, absolutely. We cited cases stating that's clear because that's new conduct. That's a new act. You're absolutely right, Judge. That takes place post-petition. That takes it out of the, quote, general rule. I mean, what I was getting at before, if you tease this out, think what happens every day in this building in bankruptcy cases. Debtor files, creditor files a proof of claim 1,000 times a day. If you carry this to its logical conclusion, then the debtor files an objection to the creditor's claim. Again, happens every day. By this logic, the debtor is imposing costs at this point on the creditor because they have to now litigate the claim.
Right, but they're unavoidable. And the question is, if the debtor goes too far and is sanctioned, whether this sanction ought to be...
This was not a sanction, Judge. This was simply her claims against us for non-dischargeability, which she lost on. Her claims for non-dischargeability, this is just the cost award associated with it. As Judge Doyle held, they go hand in hand. What the district court distinguished on this factual predicate, it's a red herring.
Well, costs imposed on the debtor?
The cost in the arbitration award. The arbitration panel did not elaborate why they did this, which is an interesting question. Why did they do it? It doesn't matter.
Well, why did they do it?
This candid answer is nobody knows. We speculated because we figured you may want an answer to that in our papers. The most logical explanation is she sued 40 people. They settled one by one or in groups. By the time the 3-week evidentiary hearing came on her fraud claims, there were 3 defendants left, Mr. Rubin and 2 others. So they had a 3-week hearing before the panel. After the hearing, but before the ruling, she settled with the other 2 remaining defendants. So only Rubin was left standing. She settled for a substantial sum. The panel in their ruling, it was not a reasoned ruling, it was a 1 or 2 page ruling, said they were considering the claims that had been dismissed and the ones remaining against the only man left standing, Rubin, at that point. So the long-winded answer to your question, why did they do it, besides us not knowing, the best evidence or the best speculation is she had collected large sums from all the other defendants and Mr. Rubin. But she lost on these remaining fraud claims. So the panel, the best guess is she was a winner in some sort of way, and perhaps that's why they tax costs against
Did Rubin object to this costs award?
He didn't object to the cost award because he didn't have to
go
there.
Because he expected them to be discharged.
We didn't need a cannon when a fly swatter would do. We didn't have to go there.
Are you saying that the arbitration panel found in favor of Rubin on the fraud claims?
Absolutely.
I'm having difficulty getting that out of the language of their ruling.
The panel held, quote, she shall take nothing on her claims. That's on each level of the case. What's most interesting is that her original complaint, the adversary, had 3 counts, these 3 fraud claims. Then she amended, by the way, the district court affirmed on that ground. They did not cross appeal. That is not before you. But her claims for non-dischargeability, those are over. She lost. After she lost, she amended her complaint to add this 4th count that, okay, I lost on my millions of dollars on non-dischargeability, tens of millions of dollars, but the panel issued this cost award. So I'm going to amend my adversary to say, well, those are somehow post-petition. That's the only count left before.
Why would the arbitration panel award costs if it knew they were dischargeable?
Well, you're presuming a lot there, Judge. That wasn't before them.
What wasn't before them?
They're a panel dealing with her straightforward fraud claims. What were left at that point were 3 fraud claims. The panel has unfettered discretion, frankly, in terms of what it wants to do for costs. So it wasn't before the panel. You know, was the panel perhaps aware that he was in bankruptcy? Again, speculation, but common sense would say yes. But it wasn't before. They gave a 2-page simple decision saying she loses on her millions of dollars in non-dischargeability claims. And as an afterthought, he has to pay this cost award for $171,000. But the legal principle, which we've run away from, is the panel was only considering pre-petition claims. They go hand in hand. Otherwise, you end up, though I only care about winning this case, you care about broader things. And if you go beyond this case, without being too dramatic, you open up a Pandora's box. I have exceeded my time.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Cheslovsky. Ms. Thibbert-End? That's how you pronounce your name? I don't know.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Megan Thibbert-End, and I represent the appellee, Laura Lee K. Bell. There are four critical, undisputed facts that control this appeal. On April 6, 2010, Mr. Rubin filed his Chapter 7 bankruptcy petition. 4 months after the discharge order was entered, Mr. Rubin filed a motion to stay Ms. Bell's adversary proceeding before the bankruptcy court in order to, quote, allow all Bell's claims against him to be litigated in the first instance in the arbitration. By doing so, Mr. Rubin agreed to throw his hat in the arbitration ring with his former law firm and partners post-discharge, and he admits here today that the arbitration was proceeding without him. He had no reason to join the arbitration at that point in time. On March 6, 2012, pursuant to its discretion, the arbitration panel issued an award finding Mr. Rubin liable for Ms. Bell's portion of the AAA administrative costs and fees. Further, Mr. Rubin in his reply brief concedes, quote, but of course, the cost award at issue here is not tied to any separate conduct committed by Rubin other than his mere decision to join the arbitration. These facts are undisputed, according to Mr. Rubin himself in his briefing and here today. The central issue for the court is determining what particular conduct led to the award. Now, the district court properly focused not on how the ball initially got rolling, in this case, Ms. Bell's pre-petition complaint against Mr. Rubin, but rather that the award resulted because of Mr. Rubin's decision to pursue a path that led to his post-discharge obligation. Now, Mr. Rubin argues that he was merely defending against Ms. Bell's pre-petition claims, so the award must be discharged. But we cannot ignore that Mr. Rubin chose to leave the protections of bankruptcy court and choose an alternative venue in which to defend against Ms. Bell's claims. That choice was not free. In doing so, Mr. Rubin subjected himself to the AAA's rules, including Rule 50, which grants them unlimited discretion to assess administrative costs. Mr. Rubin's concession that the award is not tied to Ms. Bell's substantive claims is fatal to his appeal.
Why did it's a substantial costs award? Why did the arbitration panel award these costs to him if he didn't prevail in some sense?
Well, we would argue, Your Honor, that they awarded the costs because we did prevail in some sense. I would disagree with counsel's characterization of that. It's true that the parties agreed that we would not require a reasoned award by the arbitration panel, so we got what we asked for. But the award is quite clear that what the panel says is that the damages attributable to Mr. Rubin's conduct had been compensated. So I
had
think
been
it's
what? I'm
had
sorry.
Been compensated is what uh-huh. the award says. I think it's logical that the arbitration panel wanted Mr. Rubin to have some responsibility for his conduct. And given their determination that the damages had already been covered, they issued the award against him so that he would have that accountability.
But they didn't say that, right?
They didn't, Your Honor. They didn't, Your Honor. But I think the award, I think it's quite reasonable that had they not believed that Mr. Rubin had some liability here, they would not have assessed costs against him. But we won't know. The reality is that the arbitration panel had unlimited discretion. And they used it here. What's significant, Your Honor, is that if the award was not tied to Ms. Bell's substantive claims, as Mr. Rubin admits, then it was the result of that decision to join the arbitration. That's what's important here. That's the key event that the appellant in this case continues to ignore. He would like for the court only to analyze Ms. Bell's filing of her pre-petition complaint and then the issuance of the award and ignore all of the intervening events. Well, the district court didn't do that here. But further, let's assume for a second that the award is connected to Bell's remaining substantive claims, or was at the time when the award was issued. Mr. Rubin is in a catch-22 here, and we address this in our brief. if the award is tied to the pending claims, all that were pending were fraud claims, and those would similarly be non-dischargeable. Had Mr. Rubin decided, as was his right, that he would stand behind the protections of the bankruptcy court and the stay provision, my client would have been forced to litigate her claims against him in the adversary proceeding. It was Mr. Rubin's choice to pursue that alternative litigation venue. He wanted to defend his claims alongside his former law firm and his former partners. He told the district court that the reason he did it was for efficiency and judicial economy. That may be, but that doesn't make it any less a choice. And making that choice exposed Mr. Rubin to a post-discharge liability here. Now, the district court focused very specifically on two cases, the In re Haddon case and the In re SureSnap case, one from the Western District of Wisconsin and the other from the 11th Circuit. Notably, the reasoning from these cases was also recently adopted by the 9th Circuit Appellate Bankruptcy Panel in the In re Gillespie case, which is a case that now overturns a bankruptcy opinion that Mr. Rubin relied on in his opening brief. These cases included a debtor not unlike Mr. Rubin, who took affirmative action after the discharge order. Mr. Rubin moved to stay the adversary proceeding 4 months after his bankruptcy was closed. These cases, they stand for the proposition that debtors don't get a free pass for their post-petition conduct, as Your Honor properly noted. If you engage in conduct after your bankruptcy, you're responsible for it, and that's what we have here today. This case is completely unlike the cases that Mr. Rubin relies on in his briefs. Those cases, they deal with a statutory or contractual attorney fee. The creditor had a contingent right to fees prior to the filing of the bankruptcy petition in those cases, either by contract or by statute. That's not what we have here. Mr. Rubin admits that the cost award did not derive from any express contract right between the parties. It similarly did not result because of a statutory right to fees. We know that. It accrued.
But are you arguing that no expenses incurred after the filing of the bankruptcy petition can be discharged?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor. What I'm arguing is that...
Well, I mean, suppose the bankrupt is in order to, you know, get his discharge, he incurs various costs, you know, litigation costs and so on. Can they never be tied back to the pre-petition creditor's claim that he's defending against?
No, Your Honor, there are cases where costs that were incurred during the bankruptcy and during a discharge proceeding are dischargeable. That's not what we have here. These are not costs or fees that were created while we litigated in the adversary proceeding against Mr. Rubin. These are different from this particular circumstance that Your Honor refers to. These were an entirely different proceeding. These were fees.
Well, they were substitutes, right? Just an alternative forum.
They were it was
arbitration versus litigation.
An alternative forum, and they were fees that never would have existed had Mr. Rubin not joined the arbitration. He never would have been exposed to the award had he stayed in the bankruptcy proceeding. They would not have existed in this case if the adversary complaint had been argued before the bankruptcy court.
He would have had to defend against the adversary complaint.
He would have had to defend against the
adversary complaint. And he'd incur costs and so on. And wouldn't they be dischargeable?
Your Honor, we would have had no statutory contractual right to attorney's fees if this case had been litigated before the bankruptcy court. That's accurate. The only reason we are entitled to fees is because this case proceeded in an alternative venue that Mr. Rubin chose, the arbitration. That was the cost of making
that choice.
That
seems kind of arbitrary. The alternative venue, the arbitration, may be a cheaper way of resolving these disputes than the adversary proceeding. So.
Admittedly, Your Honor, it may be cheaper. That doesn't make Mr. Rubin any more or less liable for the award. Efficiency or economy is a choice, Your Honor. It's he was not compelled to arbitrate in this case. Your Honor, what I would say, as I see that I'm running out of time, what I would say in conclusion to the court is that we know that bankruptcy may not be used by debtors as a shield to insulate them from the costs of their post-bankruptcy conduct. Mr. Rubin agreed post-discharge to join an arbitration that he wasn't a party to, he had no requirement to participate in, and in doing so, he subjected himself to the panel's authority to assess costs. The district court got it right here, and we ask that the court affirm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Thibbert. And Mr. Cheslovsky, how much time does he have?
Yes.
Oh, your time expired, but you can have a minute or so.
Thank you, Judge. A few things briefly. There is not a single case where a debtor, not one, where a debtor is held liable for these type of costs, except where the debtor has something to gain. In the Haddon case, the debtor had an exempt asset it was trying to protect. If the debtor had won, the debtor would get something. In the case we cited last week that we gave the authority to this court, the Gillespie case, the debtor had 12 counterclaims in the underlying state court case. It was using it as a sword, not a shield. Again, I'll be redundant. There is not one case where when a debtor was only defending against non-dischargeability claims that those costs became post-petition, not subject to discharge. She keeps saying Rubin had a liability. Rubin does have a liability, but it's a pre-petition liability, period. It travels with her claims. They go hand in hand. The other notion, the final point is, this implicitly would overrule the Supreme Court's case in Travelers. There was a big brouhaha for years, which is if a contract provides for attorney's fees, and then in the bankruptcy case, the creditor has these attorney's fees. For a long time, there was a question, does the creditor get to add those fees to its claim? The Supreme Court resolved that in Travelers. The answer is yes. That's the easy part. But it adds it to its claim as its pre-petition unsecured claim, because it all stems from a pre-petition act. This would be a first. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel. Next case for our